Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Today, we have with us Hale Bullen. Hale is an investment manager with PS27 Ventures. Hale, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Christian. Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we kick things off? PS27, love to learn what the fund's investment thesis is.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously based out of Jacksonville, Florida, and the fund thesis, like most funds, kind of evolves over time. Okay. As of last week, we've kind of graduated to kind of what we like to call kind of our three core principles. Okay. And all of them kind of come under the AI umbrella, right? Everyone's talking about AI and venture and kind of the financial services landscape. But the way that we like to kind of establish our investment framework under that umbrella is kind of within B2B SaaS, FinTech, and health tech, yep. Right? We are located in Jacksonville, Florida. We have financial services kind of throughout the North Florida region. And we also have a ton of hospitals. So it makes sense that we're kind of playing in that FinTech and health tech space. But even furthermore, there's one kind of commonality that we have in all of our portfolio companies that we've invested in out of this fund. And that's what we like to call sticky plumbing. What is sticky plumbing, Christian? So think about the plumbing in your home.
Yeah.
Think about the kind of water pipes, right? When they go in, they're built when the house is being constructed. But how often are you going and actually replacing those pipes on a day-to-day basis or a weekly basis, right? Nominally, never. And those are the kinds of software companies that we like to invest in. You're never going to know their name outside of the announcement that we've invested. They're just going to go ahead and keep doing their thing year in and year out as employees churn. And the software will just be embedded for as long as possible. So the deeper in the bowels of the company that it is, the more attractive it is to us.
You know, I'm reminded of Vista Equity Partners, because I know part the way I've heard them frame it is, you know, it's identical premise, but it's, you know, it's like, what's the last software to go?
Yeah.
When a company has, you know, cash flow issues. And you know, just like you described, it's like honing in on mission critical technology that companies need to run their business. So it makes great sense. Mm-hmm. Your role, investment manager, how do you spend your time inside PS27?
Yeah, Christian, that's a great question. And to be quite frank, that's been one of the funnest aspects of being an IM at PS27, because that is constantly changing on a day-to-day basis. But I think in short, really, I'm kind of the front door. Think of it as the greeter, if you will. Yeah. All the deal flow promulgates through our team, whether it's through events, whether it's through our network. And ultimately, I'm the first look at the founder, the pitch, and anything else that the company wants to send over. Unfortunately, it's not. Typically, it's a bunch. We look at probably a couple thousand deals per year. And ultimately, we're kind of deciding, hey, let's open the door for this company and kind of walk them through our diligence process and show them our house. Or, hey, you know, maybe you're not ready yet, but come back to us once you've met X, Y, and Z kind of wickets. And then we can let you into the house to kind of walk you through for a potential investment.
And so let's talk about due diligence then. So, you know, sounds like a tremendous amount of deal flow, like many funds. What's the key criteria, notwithstanding mission critical software, that you're looking at potential investments through?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So we do have a minimum revenue threshold, which we think is probably one of the best indicators of whether a company is investable or not, right? You can have the best pitch deck, kind of the best story ever, but is there traction? We want to see traction. We want to see your client list. And typically we like to call that about 240,000 to 300,000 in ARR. That's kind of our initial threshold outside of, hey, does it fall categorically into what we're looking to invest in? Obviously, our diligence process, like most firms, takes quite a bit. We typically take anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks. So there's multiple steps that the founders need to kind of work through before they actually receive an investment from PS27. But My personal favorite event is what we call a workout, right? And that's actually the culminating event before we actually close an investment. Why is that my favorite? We actually bring our entire firm to that session, and we invite the company to bring obviously their founder and CEO, but we also invite them to bring their executive team to that 4-hour session. And the way we like to think of it is kind of as a Thanksgiving dinner, right? We kind of have both sides of the family coming together. For us, we're trying to close any loose ends that we may have on diligence and kind of fill in any gaps that we may have. And it's really cool because we kind of ask some open-ended questions and we get a chance to see how the team in real time works together to answer some of the questions from our PMs that work with the companies after we invest. Obviously, the investment committee at that point has asked a couple hundred questions and they're sick of us. But it's really cool to see what questions the team has on our end and then seeing how the company responds in real time to answer, hey, what did we miss in diligence? And also, hey, let's plan ahead. What do the next 100 days look like after we cut you a $500,000 check, $1 million check? Because that's really, really insightful when it comes to now taking this idea of an investment and actually turning that into an action step in a couple of days.
So I love the Thanksgiving table analogy, and I think there's I've heard other funds do something similar, but they're looking for grit, they're looking for interaction, and so how close well, I heard you loud and clear in revenue, but how close is the founders weighted in the overall process, and are there any key profiles that you try to surface when considering their responses to your questions?
Yeah, so when we think about profiles, obviously we want a background in the industry that the founder is operating. And I think that's a given, right? We don't, if someone's op creating a software company and they have no software background whatsoever, that's kind of a bit of a red flag. So alignment in their experience and kind of the industry that they're playing in, right? I think the other that we like to see is, hey, what is the consistency in the messaging that goes from the initial conversation to kind of the initial meeting with our investment committee, to a financial review, to a tech review, to a competitive analysis, and finally to that workout step, right? And what do I mean by the messaging? One of the questions that we always ask is, hey, founder X, what was your revenue this past month, right? And back to the revenue, so as an example. And we ask that question during every single one of the reviews, even the competitive analysis, because oftentimes we hear a different number every month, right? Which is not a good thing, Christian. That's never a good thing. We want that number to be the same. Obviously, we expect growth, but again, it's only 6 to 8 weeks. So we don't expect that number to change by $100,000. So that's a small example, but we want the messaging to remain consistent to say, hey, how airtight is that story, right? Typically, the longer and more verbose that story is initially, the less attractive of an investment it is for us. So we typically like, let's cut straight to the chase. We want to know the facts. We want to know the customers. And we want to know that there's actual interest and market demand for the product that you have created. So I'd say that when we measure a founder, that's kind of one of the biggest things that we're looking for, outside of obviously the fit with it and their experience in that vertical.
I love it. And you got me smiling because we do something similar with our interview process. When we're looking to hire staff for our company. We look at how consistent, their explanations are across different members of our team who interview them. But we also then look at, how direct or indirect are they in answering our questions. And usually what we find, the more direct, the more credible they are. And, the more words they have to use, something's going on there. So I love it. That's great. A little bit in the weeds about running the firm, but a topic that's come up is the role of AI in evaluating deal flow. Obviously I don't want you to reveal any trade secrets, but would love to hear, the extent that you're automating or leveraging AI for purposes of evaluating deal flow, or just more broadly in general, running the business.
Sure. It's funny because it's a question that we're constantly asking ourselves, saying, hey, what processes do we currently have today that we can improve, right? If you're not improving, you're falling behind. And that's very true in VC. And So to answer your question bluntly, we use AI at every single step in our process, from the initial call that we have with the founder to we actually do have kind of a proprietary trading, or not trading, but rather a proprietary grading formula that we have for the founders that we run after every single call. That again kind of measures the consistency. And we have a set of about 40 characteristics that we're grading the founder on or the respective team member, because sometimes we have calls with CTOs, CMOs, board advisors. And we're assessing, hey, is this someone that we think we can work with? Is this someone based on traits from some of the most successful startups in the past? We've kind of aggregated that data set and said, hey, we now have this massive data set. We know kind of the traits that we want. Now, how do the founders that we're talking to today stack up against some of the most successful founders in the past? So the short answer to your question is every single step in that diligence process, we are using AI for. My personal favorite, though, today, especially for competitive analyses. And I have to give a shout out to one of our cowork at Deepwork Capital in Orlando, Florida. He put me onto it. But Grok AI from XAI has been an incredible tool, especially today when it comes to doing competitive analyses. So my personal favorite, and a shout out to them.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for sharing. It seems like there's no shortage of tools
Yeah.
that surface every week. In fact, our engineers, have shared, oh my gosh, it's a bit overwhelming to sift through all the different solutions that are coming on market. So, great to know. One of the th obviously a lot of people have referenced 2025 as the year of AI agents. We're seeing investment themes around converting manual work into automated flows. And so how is that, has that manifested itself at all in the health tech, fintech, B2B companies that you're bullish on?
Absolutely. One of our portfolio companies, OnRamp, is actually leveraging AI agents to onboard new products at companies wherever they may be implementing the technology. So, as a quick example, CVS, who's one of their clients, whenever they have a new drug that they want to kind of introduce to a store to bring onto a shelf, that actually takes a good bit of time from CVS giving the stamp of approval to say, yes, we want this new Tylenol or new whatever the drug might be on the shelf to actually. Us, you or I, Christian, being able to purchase it. So what they did was they've taken that time from about 6 months and with their AI agent, and that they've shortened it to about 1.5 to 2 months. So in real time, we are actively investing in that. And when we kind of look at some of the Q1 reports, just from Crunchbase, from PitchBook, I mean, agentic AI agents and just agentic AI in general is one of the most common terminologies brought up in board meetings across the world. So we're not just talking about it. We're not just investing it. Everybody is talking about it. So very, very prevalent in our day-to-day activities.
I mean, it makes complete sense. I mean, I'm sure, like yourself. I mean, it seems at this point, copilots are prevalent. I don't think there's any debate of the productivity gains that users are seeing, and so I think it makes natural sense that the next stage of this is going to be how do we do full bore automation.
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's one of my favorite things to do, Christian, is before I go to bed every night, the deep research. I mean, every single Gen AI has the deep research, but before I go to bed, I love any task that I may have or kind of question that may have been unanswered. I'll usually typically open up three screens and have a different Gen AI running concurrently and just kind of run the prompt and then wake up. First thing you see is, hey, great, that hour that you're working, right? Because it can do work while you're asleep. It's a beautiful thing to have that extra set of hands to actually do that while you're sleeping. So they're incredible. We're all in.
100% agreed. I have a feeling, I have a strong feeling we're not going to recognize the world of productivity 5 years from now,
No.
maybe let alone three. So with that, any technologies in particular or workflows in particular you're bullish on as you're looking at making investments?
Yeah, it's interesting. Let's jump to the fintech space for a second, just because crypto has kind of been in the limelight. We do not invest in crypto. It's kind of or Web3, NFTs. It's been kind of one of the areas that we'd like to avoid. But when we talk about flexibility and payments, that's been one of the areas that we've been very, very interested in, right? How do we enable the siloed payment system that we live in today? to create a network of payments that allow ease of trans, really ease of transit of cap, not necessarily capital, but just dollars and cents from me to you. Because today, if Christian, if you and I were to go out to dinner, and let's say not both of us didn't have Venmo or both of us didn't have Zelle, we would have a slight issue in trying to pay the other one back, right? So one of our core areas of interest is, hey, what companies are creating solutions that enable that seamless P2P transfer of cash from me to you? The answer may be crypto. Is the answer crypto today? No. But there are a couple compelling opportunities that we're looking at today that are very exciting, and I think have a number of people in the Southeast specifically excited when it comes to enabling that seamless transfer. But payments specifically are an area that are really exciting for us, and I believe we're going to see a significant amount of development in the next 3 to 10 years.
So hey, checks cut. What's the degree of support that the firm is providing your founders?
Absolutely. So after the check is cut, and remember back to the workout, right? That's where we've kind of laid out the next 100 days. What does that look like in practice once the check is in hand? Great. Check's in hand. We require that every single one of the companies that we invest in is part of what we call our sales call process for the first year after investment. What is a sales call? Obviously, we expect a board to be set up by the company. There's a governance structure in place, and there's quarterly board meetings held. But what's beautiful about the sales call process that we require our portfolio companies to be on is that's outside of the board meetings altogether. It's a weekly call that we hold every single Friday, and it's with our general partner, Jim Stallings, sits on it. We also have two portfolio managers just on that call, and myself. And ultimately, it's an open sounding board for the founders to come to us and say, hey, what's going well? What's not going well? And ultimately, give us homework as the VC, right? Because ultimately, I mean, through the diligence process, we've been giving them homework. Hey, we want to see your P&L, your balance sheet. Let's see some real solid and tight financial projections for the next 3 to 5 years, right? They've gone through 6 to 8 weeks of diligence. It's time for them to give us some homework. So every single week we leave as a firm with homework and we ultimately help them, right? That's kind of the deal that you make. They're going to go out, they're going to get customers, and ultimately we're there as kind of that open sounding board week in and week out to help them fill in the gaps. So every single week that's what we do. It's about a 30-minute session, and it's been really fun once the comp we've had a couple of the companies in our previous fund get to the year mark, and we've gotten there and we're saying, hey, congratulations, you've kind of made it to the year. We don't need to see you every week. We've taught you everything you need to know. You've done it exceptionally well. We'll see you in a quarter. We'll just bump it out to the quarter so you can go back to being a founder and doing the job. And many of the founders have come back and said, whoa, whoa, whoa. Wait, I really enjoy these talks every week. This is great. So it's been really reassuring to see that happen. But that I would say is probably our biggest or largest level of involvement is that week in and week out, kind of the back and forth with the founders, and obviously the kind of the connections. Once we kind of get to the level of, hey, they've graduated to the point where they're at the revenue target where we expect some of the other introductions we may be able to make are appropriate, whether that's for another funding round or for a new potential customer for the portfolio company themselves. That's typically a little bit further down the road, but I'd say those are the main two avenues post-investment.
I mean, my opinion is I think it's smart. One just due diligence criteria number one, revenue agreed. People are going to give you money for what you have, and very objective assessment. But two, I agree. I mean, filling the top of the funnel, getting deals or opportunities to work through the pipeline. My opinion is that should be a core focus of a founding team. And so, out of curiosity, so any patterns or any key takeaways that the firm has picked up on over the years?
Yeah, no, that is such a good question. And I think this kind of goes to the venture capital trends that we've seen since kind of the early 2020s. And our previous fund's vintage year was 2021. So let's just take that as kind of our starting point to now, right? So 2021, 2022, I mean, what a strange time to start a fund, right? Kind of on the precipice of COVID. going in. We're at very strange investment timeline, but we saw very inflated valuations. We saw massive round sizes really from 2021 to 2023, and those started to taper off, right? There's always a lag from a major kind of event and seeing that how that actually impacts the sector writ large. And we almost enabled ideas that may not have been typical venture investments before that time period, right? And that's specifically with the larger round sizes and the fear of FOMO, right? No one wants to miss out. Everyone's sitting at home. Like, we need to be involved in kind of the next great idea. So you see a lot of capital flowing into ideas that may not have been ideas that would have been invested in beforehand. So one of the things that we've noticed is, and we've kind of taken into practice is, hey, founder comes to us and they're looking to raise, let's say, a $10 million seed extension or a Series A. The question then becomes, hey, what do you plan to use that $10 million for? Right? And 90% of the time, it's going to be, hey, we're going to use it for marketing or we're going to use it for dev work, right? We're going to build out a team. We're going to hire some software engineers. And then the second question is, okay, what's your familiarity with AI? And everyone says, oh, I'm very familiar with AI. And so then the third question then becomes, Christian, all right, well, if you're this familiar with AI, then why do you need to hire five engineers at $180,000 a year? How are we now able to reduce the round size to enable smart capital spending by the founder? So oftentimes we're trying to move away from where we started, right, with participating in some of the larger rounds and trying to coach the founder and saying, hey, maybe you don't necessarily need as large of a funding round as what you previously may have needed if you were raising capital 3 years ahead of time. So oftentimes we're encouraging the founder, hey, maybe just raise a $2 million round. Maybe just raise a $3 million round. And oftentimes, if there is a good enough answer that, hey, we actually do need $5 to $10 million, sure, that makes sense. But more often than not, that extra added layer of thought and that discussion, the back and forth that we have with the founders before we even invest, lends itself to the founder willing to move themselves left and say, yeah, you know what? PS27, maybe we didn't need to raise that much capital. And we're willing to raise a smaller round. A, to not prolong the fundraising process, since that is a very hectic time in kind of any founder's lifestyle, right? But B, to stop it and just get back to doing work, right? What's the whole point of raising money? That is not an end goal of any company to have endless fundraising rounds. The end goal is to create a company and to make a vision that the founder has come true. And oftentimes that's enabled even further by having a smaller funding round.
So, two thoughts, or two questions. When I hear that, and I agree with your assessment, I find myself in a lot of conversations where people are, looking at revenue per employee, bottom line, and there seems to be consensus that artificial intelligence is enabling founders to do more with less. So that begs the question is, well, if that's true, what's the impact of venture? So would love to hear your opinion as to what the downstream effect is to this segment of investors.
Oh my God, this is such a good question, Christian. It's something that it's funny because you see some of these really large funds, right? The $100 million funds, the $500 million funds. And from an LP's perspective, you start wondering, hey, if I'm operating on a typical 2-in-20 model, right, your 2% fee management that's always charged to an LP and the kind of the 20% carried interest, what am I really paying a 2% of these large $500 million funds for? What am I getting out of it? Because oftentimes at that point, you have a team that's just oversaturated, way too large, and you're paying fee ultimately harvesting fees to kind of feed that large ecosystem and team that's been built out. That's kind of been why we've kind of chosen the opposite direction, right? We are going to raise consecutive $20 to $25 million funds and just keep participating in the same sector. What do we know? We know pre-Series A early stage companies, and we don't need to raise a $100 million fund to be successful. We can keep our team small, we can keep our team lean, and we're going to hire people based on their ability to adapt and use AI tools effectively. We don't need a 20-person team to do that. No, you need the core team that's currently in place and their ability via our continuous learning. We actually implement, we have a KPI that we track every quarter of continuous learning. And the majority of that, we've seen our team kind of gravitate towards learning the new AI tools to stay relevant and to ultimately ensure, hey, we don't need to become this bloated, kind of excessive model that we see many VCs that have become that since that 2021 year. But that's probably a longer answer to your question, but that's kind of how we view it.
No, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I love the conviction. And so I'm also curious, what about so coming back to revenue as a metric, what other performance KPIs are you guys looking at to assess performance over time?
Yeah, so I mean, we're pretty straightforward, right? When it comes to kind of what we're looking for, we want a reasonable burn rate. And this kind of goes back to, excuse me, to revenue. Excuse me. Well, kind of to revenue, kind of to new customers coming in, right? And we expect that there's going to be a runway of about 1.5 to 2 years, regardless of the round size that we're looking at. We also want the founders to have as much equity as possible because we're typically looking at seed, Series A companies, right? So a founder that's less or co-founding aggregate. That's le has less than 40% equity on the cap table post conversions of any notes or other debt that may be on the cap table to before a priced round. That's a red flag to us, right? That's kind of outside the scope of just kind of where we're thinking, right? And now we kind of bring that into performance, right? We expect that every single company that we invest in is going to be able to at least double their revenue every 6 months to a year. This kind of goes back to your original question of, hey, what do we look for from founders, right? What's kind of one of the things we're looking for? Consistent messaging and good financial projections. We don't need you to project that you're going to 5x your revenue the year after we invest because we don't necessarily even think that's realistic, right? We want you to focus in a very narrow space, execute the go-to-market strategy that you've outlined to us, or maybe we've helped you formulate it, and just 2x revenue year after year. Because if you do that, you're going to hit the hockey stick growth that you are now conveying to all current investors and future investors coming in for potential future funding rounds. The other kind of goal that I'll outline, Christian, really quickly is we are entering, sure, the fund life cycle is 10, it's a 10-year fund, right? That's pretty standard. But we are anticipating exiting a company in 3 to 5 years, right? That's kind of the timeline that we're looking for. And that's typically one of the early questions that we ask for is, hey, how can you 2x revenue? What does that look like in practice? And ultimately, in 3 to 5 years, when someone does come calling because you've 2x'd your revenue, are you willing to sell? And what does that exit strategy actually look like tangibly? So that's something that it's a conversation we have before we even invest that we want the founder constantly thinking about as they're going on this journey of growing their company.
It makes really good sense. I think having that alignment, eliminates friction down the road. I'm curious. So obviously higher interest rate environment, it's having impact on lots of ways, shapes, and forms. How do you guys, that being the case, how do you guys think about profitability?
Yeah, I mean that's a one of when we talk about revenue growth, it goes hand in hand with saying, hey, when are you going to break even and when does profitability occur? If there's one of the kind of final metrics that we grade on at that last session, the workout is, hey, is there a clear path to break even in profitability? And if there is no clear line of sight to it, oftentimes we won't invest. Even though we've gone through about 2 months of diligence, if it is not looking like there's a clear path and the founder does not set on that path, we'll walk away altogether. Especially because of the kind of tumultuous environment that we're in now. When we talk about exiting, right, and the barring that has to happen oftentimes to acquire some companies, I mean, it becomes a much more competitive landscape when you do kind of reach that top of the funnel and you're looking to exit. So that's one of the reasons why it's such an important question that we hone in on at the beginning is to make sure that, hey, obviously we have that line of sight, but does the founder that we're investing in also have that same line of sight?
I agree. I think, what I hear you describing is optionality, especially, presuming there's alignment that you have a 3 to 5 year time horizon. Because yeah, we're not seeing the same multiples anymore, that's for sure. Like everyone, for the rare exception. And yeah, I mean, AI is disrupting vintages. Because people are doing more with less. So I think it makes good sense.
It's been really fascinating to that point, Christian, of seeing the typical life cycle of a VC firm, right? Is hey, we raise a fund, we're at the $25 million to start. Great, that fund goes well. Fund two is at 50. And you know what? We're not going to look at pre-seed or seed anymore. We're going to look at Series A. And then, oh, we conquered that. Now we're going to raise a $100 million fund. We're going to be in Series A, Series B. And you kind of continue that way. But we've actually seen almost a reversal in that cycle where family offices and VC firms are re looking at these overinflated valuations and going backwards and saying, hey, you know, maybe this traditional life cycle of a firm doesn't make as much sense as it used to. And we're seeing specialization, not just in specific verticals, but in specific, hey, we're now going to specialize in seed rounds. We're now going to specialize in just pre-Series A rounds, wherever it might be, just because we have different firms now seeking out those better deals instead of having to pay a premium.
No, it makes complete sense. And I haven't thought about it in those terms, but I like how you frame it. Because you're right. I mean, we have conversations with investors all the time. And these days everyone is pretty clear as to what they're looking for. And it makes good sense. Hale, awesome podcast, great insights. Really impressed with how you guys are tackling things. One of the things though too is obviously there's just a human element to what we do. And so, hadn't asked, but now's a good time. How'd you get into the venture? What was the lead in? And how did the career trajectory unfold that you find yourself as an investment manager today?
Yeah, great question, Christian. It's funny because it's something that I never would have considered being a career path for me. I went to the Naval Academy just like you and kind of went along my career as a nuclear engineer, surface side, and going from nuclear reactors to moving out to Jacksonville, where there's not many reactors in Jacksonville, which was fine. It's kind of a nice break, right? But kind of keeping the engineering hat on, finishing grad school, actually got picked up to work as the lead engineer at a startup here in Jacksonville, which was exceptional. And that was kind of my first foray into kind of the entrepreneurial world. We also started a company, the blankets that we all slept on at school, the blue magnets. We actually started a blazer company around that. So that was kind of our second foray, kind of in the entrepreneurial world, concurrently with being the engineer at this startup called Tended Bar. Was with them while they were doing their Series A, and that's when I got first exposed to kind of the venture side. And I remember thinking, wow, these venture guys, they seems pretty nice to be on the other side of the table. This is kind of an interesting, the questions they're asking, kind of the forward-looking statements that they're making, kind of that business development mindset and looking forward and helping the CEO and founders was something that was really attractive to me. So I applied to PS27, which is ironically the only venture fund in town, and offered to jump on as an intern. And Jim said, absolutely, come on in. We'll show you, teach you everything that I know. And now coming up on almost 2 years, starting off as an intern for 2 months, a year as our investment analyst, and now the investment manager. It's been incredible. And it's not something I would have ever expected.
Fantastic. How has your time as an operator influence how you look at founders today?
Certainly. I obviously the leadership that you have coming out of the Navy is it's second to none. I mean this is a shameless pitch for the military. I mean it's an incredible experience that I'm incredibly grateful for. And like going to now working with hundreds of people on an aircraft carrier to then looking at a small startup that's less than 10 people, and it's a fascinating kind of shift in mindset of, all right, it's just a lot more people that you're working with, right? To kind of split up the different tasks that need to get done. And now you look at a 10-person company and there's arguably sometimes more tasks need to get done amongst 10 people. So that was a, especially now being in the seat and realizing, oh my gosh, this is actually, I need to do some of the tasks I was used to kind of farming out, not farming out, but kind of collaborating with more groups of people on became, hey, there's no more collaborating. I mean, there still is some collaboration, but you need to figure out how to do this. And if you don't know, go ask for help or find the people, maybe not at your company, but elsewhere to actually do this. So that was a big learning curve for me. And I'm just so appreciative of having sat in the seat and grinding through those late nights, this 80-hour weeks during the startup. I think it gives us a unique perspective and appreciation for the founders that we talked to because we lived it. We lived it. They made it through their Series A, and it's always fun kind of connecting on that level, that operator level, as we're going through the diligence process and post-investment. I think it gives us a very unique perspective.
I agree. It's difficult to separate my experience, but it does absolutely seem to be benefit when you can put yourself in the shoes of the founders you're investing in, because you've been there. The advice seems more practical, and it seems like there's a better connection between parties. Because the other one knows you've been there, done
Exactly.
that. So as you look back on your career, one of the questions I love to kind of tease out is a retrospective. And so, the way I frame it is, you have a conversation with your younger self. What would you share? And you're welcome to pick the age, as long, as young as you want, or as old as you want.
Maybe I'd go back to the days in Annapolis and go back as a ghost in Bancroft Hall and maybe kind of whisper, maybe just sit down and say, "Hey, Hale, look, the academy kind of teaches you there's a finite set of kind of where you're going to go into. You're going to go in the Navy or Marines, and these are the set of jobs that you have available to you in the Navy or Marines, right?" And I would tell myself, "Hey, sure, there are a discrete number of options here. However, when it comes to your career post-military, keep an open mind. Sure, it's good to actually, everyone needs to set goals and kind of have the end goal that they're working towards, but don't be afraid to take a risk and let the guiding light be taking those risks to follow the people that you trust." And ultimately, that's kind of what led me to VC, is just our Jim Stallings, who our general partner, has just been an incredible mentor, and now friend. And that's kind of, even though I never guessed that I would end up at a VC firm, kind of following that moral compass, I think, is great advice that I would have given to my younger self, just because it is such a different mindset in the career that you're going into post Naval Academy.
So, out of curiosity, I mean, I agree. I think it's great advice and counsel. Before you joined PS27, did you find that you normally sought out mentors, or did it happen happenstance?
Yeah, I think the Navy, and I'm sure you can attest to this at the Academy, I think it teaches us from an early age the value of having not just one mentor, but kind of a group or a network of mentors. That doesn't mean 20, right? Because you only have so much time. But I've typically liked to have 3 to 5 mentors kind of in my network for different purposes. Not, right? So you kind of have, hey, this is my life mentor. Someone, I just had my, we just had our first kid a little over a year ago. She just turned one. So having kind of that outside
Congratulations.
of your family, but having kind of that family mentor, I want to be this type of father. And obviously my dad, incredible mentor there, but having someone else to do that, having, hey, someone just to kind of keep tabs on the military, having that military mentor, which we have dozens, right? Having served for numbers of years in the Navy. And then obviously a professional mentor outside of the military. And so that's been really fun, just because you have so much variety out once you kind of leave the ecosystem of the Navy to just kind of the other world, the outside world, which has been just a ton of fun. But I think the short answer to your question is absolutely. I think from a very early age, I've always sought out mentors.
Yeah, I don't know if you realize it, but as I was listening to you, it's totally consistent with how you approach founders in your role at PS27. It's like engaging people who've been there and done that is really valuable. Because I've met, I can use logic and reason to, find answers, but just there's difficult to substitute experience. I like how you say, hey, where are my important buckets? And how do I find someone who's got experience there? It's great. Last question before we wrap up, and this is a more new one, is I've only started recently asking, but I'm having some fun with it. If you had an opportunity to see anybody that you'd like on the Innovators and Investors podcast, who would it be?
My first commanding officer on the Blue Ridge in Japan,
Yeah.
Captain Crozier, was my first CO, and went on, he was the commanding officer of the TR during kind of the COVID times. But he is now working at a startup in Palo Alto. So I would love to see his I would love for you to bring him on just to hear his perspective. Obviously, being kind of a senior leader in the military, and now what his experience has been translating that from, hey, senior military officer, and now leading one of the startups in Silicon Valley. I think that he'd be a great one to have on.
Noted. The list has just started growing, and we're going to add them, and we're going to see what we can do to can't get them on here.
Awesome.
Hale, if there are any of our listeners who'd like to get a hold of you, whether they're a founder, co-investor, potential LP, how can they find you?
Definitely. First name Hale, Hale at ps27ventures.com.
Fantastic. And again, for benefit of our audience, Hale Bowen, investment manager at PS27 Ventures. Hale, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Christian, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you are a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.